When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
Week's episode of the Elise Glink Show. I am Elise Glink, and I'm here to help you make smart choices about your financial life. But first, here's my Glinkonomics report on what the economic indicators have been showing me in this past week. I know it's May, but the CoreLogic Home Price Index for March just came out, and guess what? It shows continued strength in the housing market. Even lower-tiered homes are recovering their pre-crisis value. I'm Elise Glink. Here's today's Real Estate Minute. CoreLogic survey found home prices were up by 2% from February to March and 5.9% from March of 2014. Excluding distressed sales, right, foreclosures and short sales, values were up by 6.1% year over year, reaching a level that's only 6.7% off its April 2006 high. Man, are we closing in on the top. So if you subtract out distressed sales from the housing market and project the CoreLogic HPI trend going forward, what it's telling me is that we're going to be seeing new high average home prices, again excluding distressed sales, sometime next summer, 2016. Of course, around 13% of sales are still REO, real estate owned from the bank, so it may be a little premature to make those kinds of comparisons. With distressed sales, we're still a good 11% off the 2006 peak HPI. But here's another positive sign from the CoreLogic report. Homes in the lowest of the four price tiers measured by CoreLogic, which correspond to the lowest priced properties, are only a 0.5% off their all-time high. Wow, having increased by 7% already this year. It's kind of mind-blowing. And since lower home values are far more likely to be underwater, it's nice to know that they're seeing the fastest increase in average sales price. Alrighty then, let's get on with the rest of today's show. I've got three guests with me this week. I'll start off by talking to Ralph McLaughlin, who's a housing economist for Trulia. And he and I are talking about the just released rent versus buy report that Trulia puts out twice a year. It's just out, so cool news. We'll be talking about rental affordability compared to buying a home and what happens when you start factoring in those ever-rising Homeowner Association or HOA fees. Next, I've got Danielle Hale from the National Association of Realtors. She's their Director of Housing Statistics, and we're going to talk about the distressing numbers that the National Association of Realtors just released concerning rising inequality in major metropolitan areas around the U.S., and the way the housing market is adding to the momentum of that trend. In other words, people who rent versus people who buy, and what that says about inequality on a financial level. Third up is Dan Goldstein. He's the real estate reporter for MarketWatch in New York. Back with us again. He's got a list of four potential home hazards that often go undetected to share with us. And I have to tell you, listening and doing this interview, conducting the research, I've already come out with a few absolute must-have tips. And if you don't follow his advice, you could be in real trouble as well. After that, I've got an answer for someone who wrote to me with a question about buying an entire condo building and converting it back into a hotel, which is what it was to begin with. And finally, I've got a bunch of other little surprises that we're going to put at the end of this podcast, so be sure to stay tuned all the way to then to listen in. Okay, that's this week's lineup. Let's get started. Trulia just published its biannual rent versus buy report, and in it they analyzed the cost of buying versus the cost of renting a home in the 100 largest metropolitan areas of the country, as well as some national figures. The report also goes into depth this year about the impact of homeowners association fees, And you know that I hear a whole lot about HOA fees. So I'm happy to welcome Trulia's housing economist, Ralph McLaughlin, to the show to discuss these numbers and the report's findings. Ralph, welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
It's nice to have you on Big Money Real Estate. So in your report, did you find that buying beats renting despite rising home prices?
Yes, despite the fact that home prices have actually outpaced rent growth over the past year, it is now slightly cheaper to buy than to rent than it was compared to this time last year.
Now, this is kind of amazing because when I talked to the former chief economist of Trulia, he thought that it would be buying all the way just until mortgage interest rates hit maybe 5%, 5.2%. And in fact, we've seen mortgage interest rates go entirely the opposite direction, and they're now at 3.87% today for a 30-year fixed from 4.5% last year. Is that the underlying reason that buying still beats renting?
Absolutely. While it's not the only factor, it is one of the biggest factors. So despite prices outpacing rents over the past year, the fact that interest rates have gone down from 4.5 to 3.87% means that it is increasingly a better deal to buy than to rent.
Now, what about home prices and how fast those are growing in some marketplace? Are there any markets where it's still so much more expensive? It's more expensive to buy because home prices are so much more than they were a year ago.
That's correct. So on average, in the entire United States, home prices have increased about 3.9% year over year. But again, that's a national average, so it masks what's going on in individual markets. In places in the West Coast and also in Florida, prices have grown quite significantly higher than 3.9%. In fact, in some areas like here in the Bay Area or Los Angeles or South Florida, year-over-year price increases have been between 10 and 15%.
Okay. So overall, buying a home is 33% cheaper than renting nationwide?
That's correct.
Where is it? Is there any place around the country where it's cheaper to rent?
No. In fact, in all of the 100 largest metropolitan areas, it is cheaper to buy than it is to rent. However, depending on where you are in the country, the call can be a bit closer. So, for example, in places like Honolulu and New York and some places out here in California, it is slightly better to buy than to rent. But there are other factors that households will have to take into account when deciding whether it actually is cheaper. So, for example, how many years you stay in your house, what percent you itemize your property taxes at, and other things like how much of a down payment you can put down on your house.
So how does HOA fees, how do those factor into the calculus?
So we did our analysis separately. We did analysis one without HOA fees and one with the median HOA fees. And in fact, in some of the markets where it is a closer call to buy than to rent, it actually tips the favor in favor of renting. So places like Honolulu are around 16% cheaper to buy versus rent without HOA fees. But when we include HOA fees, it actually makes it 1% cheaper to rent than to buy.
How does it work, these numbers, for investors? So they're actually buying, but then they're going to rent them out. So where does it fall for them?
So investors would have to take that into account when considering their overall investment budget and especially ongoing costs. And in some markets, HOA fees can add up to anywhere between $3,000 to $6,000 a year, depending on the level of HOA fee. So, for example, in places like New York, where the median HOA fee is $575 a month, that can amount to quite a bit more costs associated with investment than in, say, a market where HOA fees are quite low. So, for example, Sacramento, the median HOA fee is only $20. So that is a much smaller cost out of pocket per year for an investor than in places like New York.
Interesting. Well, thank you so much for sharing that. Ralph McLaughlin is a housing economist at Trulia. Ralph, will you come back again? I know Trulia does a lot of really good reports. We'd love to have you back.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
There's a new report out from the National Association of Realtors on widening inequality in the vast majority of major metropolitan areas in the U.S. And a sizable chunk of that disparity can actually be rooted in trends we're seeing in the housing market. So I'm happy to welcome a new face today from the National Association of Realtors office in D.C. Danielle Hale is their Director of Housing Statistics, and she's going to fill us in on the details of the report. Danielle, welcome to Big Money Real Estate.
Thanks for having me, Elise.
So what did your report find, sort of on the high concept level?
Well, what we found is that in a time when housing prices are rising, which is building up a lot of equity for current homeowners, we're finding that the number of homeowners is decreasing. So while increasing housing wealth is great, what this means is that it's going to fewer and fewer people.
So according to Lawrence Yun, who's the chief economist over at NAR, he says that the decline in homeownership has serious implications for our economy, and he thinks is leading to a more unequal America. And I've known Lawrence for a very long time. The decline in homeownership is now what, at 63%?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. So what was it at the high, 68, 69%?
We got up to 69%. That's right. And what that means when we're talking about percentages is just that among the households that are out there, 69% of them are homeowning households.
So is the report saying to you that because rent prices are just going up, do you want to just turn that off?
I'm sorry.
Stand by. Whose phone was that? Was that your? That was our phone. Okay, sorry about that. I'm going to just ask that question again, and we'll cut into it. Mark, do you want to put me on a full screen? Perfect. Okay. So is the contention, or what you're saying basically, that because homeownership property values are going up, but renters are only seeing rent increases, that's eating up more of their gross monthly income without providing any sort of a payback in terms of rising home prices? Is that kind of what the report gets at?
Yeah, it's showing that the rising equity or the rising prices, increasing equity, which is great for current homeowners, but it increases some of the challenges for renters because not only are housing prices rising, it makes it a little bit more difficult for them to qualify to buy a home, they're, as you mentioned, seeing rent increases, which makes it difficult for them to save for the down payment to get into a home. And this data from the Federal Reserve shows that homeownership is a great means of wealth creation. So homeowners typically have a net worth that's roughly around $200,000, whereas renters typically have a net worth that's only closer to $5,000. And it's interesting to note that the median priced home is right around $200,000. So for a lot of homeowning households, owning a home is a great way for them to build up wealth. And they do this by seeing prices rise, but also just by paying down their mortgage. Every month when you put your money towards your mortgage, some of that goes to pay off the interest on the money that you borrowed, but some of that goes to build up equity, by the way, that you're paying down the principal.
So is there anything in here that talks to the age skewing of this? Because typically renters are younger. The average age of first-time homebuyers is now well over 30. It's closing in on 33 or 34. We're seeing people get married later. They're hopefully going to buy houses later. But are we skewing these numbers? Are the reports skewing the numbers because the younger people are renting versus, and super old people, I guess, are renting, but folks in the middle would typically be homeowners? How are you guys looking at that?
Yeah, so certainly, as you mentioned, the first age of the age of the typical first-time buyer had been around 30. It's now up to about 31 now. It's creeping up really slowly. Interestingly, it hasn't risen as quickly as the age at first marriage. So we haven't seen that yet, though that may be in the data that's still to come. So, but what we've seen is that this trend has been stable over time. That over time, renters tend to have a lower net worth. And as you mentioned, age is certainly a contributing factor there. Homeowners tend to have higher net worth. But one of the reasons that homeowners have higher net worth is because they've been able to use their home as a store of value and amass some equity over time by paying down their mortgage a little bit each month.
Do you find that, and this is an interesting statistic, I mean, the typical mortgage is only kept for maybe 2 years, 3 years. People are only staying in these homes 5 to 7 years typically, or maybe it's getting a little bit longer. And so the way that my mom built up home equity was literally staying in the property for 43 years and has already been in a new property for 11 years. My husband and I have been in our home for 20 years. you know, it's really about length. So if you're not keeping the mortgage and you're not paying that down every month and you're not actually staying in the home for longer than 5 to 7 years, are you ever actually going to see that equity build up?
You're right. It does take time to build up equity because there are transaction costs associated with buying a home and moving. What we found is that in our home buyer and seller survey, we found that before the housing crisis, buyers typically indicated that they would plan to be in a home 5 years or so, and sellers indicated that they had been in a home about 7 years. More recent data shows that people are staying longer, so sellers indicate that they've been in a home more like 10 years, and expectations have risen. So people do expect to stay for a little bit longer too. So I think people in the housing market do understand that concept. And I think what's also interesting to note is that renters typically move more frequently than homeowners. So they don't have the exact same buying and selling transaction costs, but it is expensive to move. And staying in one place, if you have a good job and good opportunities where you are, you know, is a great way for you to build up some equity and be stable in the home that you have. So I think that's one of those things that we talk about, one of those benefits of homeownership, and why it might be a good thing to try to transition those renters into homeownership, and why the fact that we're not seeing that happen could be a concern for renters and their future financial well-being.
One of the statistics I thought was really interesting is where you find the most unequal distribution of incomes. It wasn't a surprise to me that Stamford, Norwalk, Connecticut, and New York City, in the New York area, those places for sure have really unequal distribution of income. But Miami was sort of interesting. I guess this is the super wealthy Latin Americans who have been moving in there and other people who are coming from across the pond and buying property there. And then also, I guess, U.S. citizens who are taking advantage of favorable tax rates. But New Orleans, you said, was found to have one of the most unequal distributions of income. Why New Orleans?
That's a great question. I think any area where you see a decent amount of high earning potential leads to the possibility for there to be a wide range, a big distribution of income. And I think, you know, some of the disruptions that New Orleans has faced in the last decade with the hurricane and the recovery efforts, I think that could also play a role.
Interesting. And where did your report find is the most equal distribution of income between renters and homeowners?
You know, those are tend to be in smaller cities across the country. And I should say that this report pulled that particular income data from the American Community Survey. So we're looking at two different types of inequality here, income inequality, but also wealth inequality. And obviously, in areas where it's more, incomes are more unequal, then it makes it more difficult for those on the lower side of the income distribution to build up a substantial amount of wealth. So they're two different components, but they're very much related when we're thinking about issues of inequality.
Perfect. Danielle Hale is the Director of Housing Statistics for the National Association of Realtors based in D.C. Hey, Danielle, thanks for being with us on Big Money Real Estate.
My pleasure.
So I've had Dan Goldstein on with me a couple of times already to talk about his reporting for MarketWatch. He's their real estate reporter, and he's back today to fill me in on his report on the 4 hidden home hazards. And you can find a link to that story directly below this video. Now, I know this story is particularly meaningful to him because he spent 10 years as a volunteer firefighter and EMT. So he's seen some of these things cause huge problems firsthand, and always wants to spread the word to as many homeowners and investors as possible about the risks, financial and personal, involved with each one. Hey, Dan, thanks for coming back to Big Money Real Estate.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
So your first thing that you want to warn people about, excuse me, losing my voice after the weekend, is having the wrong smoke detectors. And what do you mean by that exactly? I didn't actually even know there were different kinds of smoke detectors.
Well, and this is a big issue. There are two primarily ones, ionization alarms and photoelectric, and they work very differently. Ionization alarms you will generally see in your kitchen, and they work with a little tiny bit of a radioactive substance that it can actually pick up fast-moving, big-burning particles. The problem with the ionization alarms, and they are in about 90% of everybody's home. We have about 100 million ionization detectors, and I'm not saying they don't do a good job, but the problem with the ionization alarms, and they are in your homes pretty much everywhere, they don't do a good job of combating what most people consider are the smoldering fires. These are for fast-moving fires. These are for fires that are in your kitchen, grease fires, fires that produce a lot of heat, a lot of smoke. The ones that kill people are smoldering fires, and they tend to occur in the bedroom, and that's where you want a photoelectric smoke detector, because they are simply better at handling and alarming sooner than the ionization alarms. In fact, there's been tests done, a lot of firefighters have done tests, that sometimes the photoelectric alarms will sound 20 to even 30 minutes before an ionization alarm will pick up these little tiny burning particles that, unfortunately, the fire isn't going to kill you, but it's the asphyxiation that's going to kill you. You may simply die from carbon monoxide poisoning before you even burned in a fire.
You know, for investors, I think, you know, as long as your smoke detector is working, you're not necessarily thinking about it. One of the things that we do for our rental units is on the anniversary date, we put in brand new batteries, check all the smoke detectors when right before somebody moves in, a new renter moves in. And then on the anniversary date, we hand over a package of batteries so that they can replace all of them all over again, so that every year you're getting the brand new smoke detectors. Because, of course, if your smoke detector doesn't even have a battery that works, it doesn't matter whether it's photoelectric or ionized, right? It's just not going to work.
Right. And there are two things there. Is not only do you want to, obviously, we talk about this all the time, is change your clocks, change your battery. But you should also change your smoke detectors every 5 to 10 years anyway.
Yes.
And if you haven't changed your smoke detector in the last 5 years, you should go out and get photoelectric smoke detectors, especially for your bedrooms. Anywhere you're expecting a slow-moving, smoldering fire, maybe from a cigarette that's been laying in bed or a couch, these are the fires that are going to kill you faster than a fast-moving grease fire that you're going to find in the kitchen. And on that same topic, Elise, it's really important that if you are buying new construction or you are renovating a house, if you can and you're willing to pay the money or your contractor is willing to do it, is to hardwire these smoke detectors. And what that means is that if one of them sounds, they'll all sound. And what that also helps do is you have AC power backup, so you're not relying on just the battery, because in almost all the fires where firefighters have encountered deaths or injuries, they've usually found a case where the fire, you know, where the smoke detector was in the house, but it had a dead battery and there was no AC power backup.
I love that suggestion. We found out this year that every 5 years you have to replace them. I'm not even sure. One of them, we kept putting in a new battery, and the years go by when you're renting out an apartment, you're not living there, or a house. You know, the years just kind of go by, right? Somebody takes a 2-year, 3-year lease, and before you know it, you're at 5 or 7 years, and you may not have replaced that smoke detector, and it's such a great reminder. Of course, there was that terrible, you always every year hear of horrible things, like, I think it was in Brooklyn, where that Orthodox Jewish family lost like 8 of their 9 children, and the wife died as well, because they didn't even have a smoke detector up in the bedroom on the second floor where the kids were. So you just hear those kinds of stories and your heart breaks, because it's just so unnecessary.
Yeah, there's even worse was actually a fire chief who died because his house was not equipped with the proper smoke detectors. He actually asphyxiated on his couch because of a slow moving fire. And typically what happens is, again, you won't be burned, but you'll simply go to sleep. And even if you wake up, you're going to be disoriented and you're not be able to find your way out. So
right. That's
why these photoelectric smoke detectors are so much better in the bedrooms, in the hallways, areas where you can have these smoldering fires rather than the fast moving fires that an ionization alarm is designed to detect.
Right. Well, let's quickly go through the other 4 hidden hazards. And I know you have more information on your Market Watch story. And again, if you're just watching this now, you can find the link for that story below the video. You've got hidden or unsafe gas lines, the ones that were used for lighting between 1860 and 1915. Okay, it's now 100 years later. How are you supposed to find those?
Well, it's very interesting because a lot of these homes are still in existence. In fact, just according to our data, and we ran some numbers, is that Chicago actually has some of the houses, the most amount of houses that were built between 1860 and 1915. New Jersey comes second and New York comes third.
But do you know why that is? Wait, just a little bit of Chicago history from the Chicago,
history buff. There you go.
So when we had the Great Chicago Fire in 1871, it destroyed most of the city. And what ended up happening, because we were gunning for the World's Fair in 1891. And so between 1872 and 1891, when the World's Fair was held, they rebuilt the entire city of Chicago. And because so much of it had gone up in smoke, rebuilt it with brick became the standard, stone became the standard, and out went all of the, basically the wood houses that had been built from prairie wood that basically went up in flames, like the minute that O'Leary's cow kicked over the bucket, or whatever you happen to believe. Mm-hmm. So that's why there was so much building that went on in Chicago. But so many places around the country had these kinds of things that were buried. The gas lines, when everything went in, it was turn of the century where you started to have gas lines get moved into the residential neighborhoods. How do you find those?
Well, and this is really one of the things which you want to do very carefully is obviously, if you're doing renovation and you're doing some contracting, if you come across some cast iron pipes, it's very important that you make sure that whatever gas connection is shut off before you open them, because actually I ran into a person who was renovating a home down in Southern Maryland, and he was removing a chandelier fixture, and he actually opened the pipe and he said, "Hey, I smell gas," and he screwed it right back up. And these are things that actually happen. These gas lines can actually still exist in your home. And like I said, they're very likely between 1860 and 1915, 1920, because obviously in the 1920s, we started having widespread electrification in houses, but they still can be there. So it's very careful that you want to check this and not just go drilling into walls willy-nilly without checking, making sure what's behind there. And obviously shutting off the gas if you are planning to do any kind of work behind the walls where you don't know what's behind that wall.
Oh, yeah. No, completely agree. Our house, the main part of our house was built in the 1880s, and it had knob and tube wiring. It had all kinds of stuff that went into it. We even had an old boarded up coal room in the basement where the coal was dumped in from the outside, and then people would go in and sort of throw it into the stove. But anyway, okay, third point, you are warning people about lightweight wood truss construction, that being a fire hazard. Tell us what that looks like.
Well, this is something that most contractors know, and certainly it is the bane of the fire service, is lightweight truss construction. And that basically, instead of having a solid wood beam, a 2x6 or a 4x6, you have a truss, and these trusses are very common. They're very lightweight. They're very strong. And about 60% of all new construction in this country uses some form of lightweight truss. The problem with the lightweight truss is as follows. It's not actually nailed together. It's actually pressed together. It's got gussets on either side. And these gussets are simply pressed into the wood. Now, they're very strong, but when they are potentially, when there's a fire impingement, they actually can pop off. And according to the U.S. Fire Administration, about more than a dozen firefighters have lost their lives since 2000 because of these lightweight trusses. There's simply no way to tell when they're going to give way. And this is actually important for contractors and homeowners to understand, is because if your house is involved in a fire and it's been burning for an hour, there's a good chance your firefighters are not going to go in to save your property. They may just have to let it burn because they're worried about collapse.
Of course,
obviously, if there's life safety, they're going to go in. But this is something that people have to know about.
Right.
So one of the things that has happened is that if these buildings contain lightweight trusses, you have to have it up to code. And that has to include a sprinkler system, and that just simply adds to the cost of your home. So if you're building a new house and you're using lightweight construction, you've got to factor on several tens of thousands for
it's a sprinkler system 15,000-20,000. Yeah, it's crazy. And then finally, your last hidden hazard for the house, stoves and television sets that tip over. So the new big flat screen TVs, if they're mounted to the wall, that's one thing. But if they're not mounted to the wall, they certainly can tip over and then obviously be a fire hazard. Stoves, we know as well, can get backed up if they're not kept up. What else about those are a concern to you?
Well, the biggest thing, obviously, and you pointed that, is the tip hazard. Generally, the wall is one of the safest places to put a TV. Parents can tell you they're very concerned about actually kids pulling over a television. That is a big hazard. In fact, like 100 children have lost their life in the past 2.5 decades as a result of these flat screens. The other thing that we've also seen is these lightweight stoves that children can actually stand on, and they have fallen. In fact, Sears had a multi-million dollar settlement because of injuries to kids because these stoves were so lightweight. These are not these big, giant cast iron stoves of 100 years ago. These are very, very light stoves that even if you set up.
But Dan, what are people doing letting their kids play on top of a stove?
Exactly.
Right?
Well, but
I mean, what is that?
But the thing is, it happens. Kids might just pull the oven door down to get up, and some of these stoves are such lightweight that you can actually tip them over if you stand or put a pot on the oven door, or your kid stands on the oven door. They can tip. So that's why it's really important that whatever house you buy, make sure that the anti-tip brackets are in place, and make sure that they are solid enough, because I've heard some stories that even if you have anti-tip brackets, sometimes they can even break themselves. So
I can't even go there. As a mother of two boys, both of whom are very active, they were never allowed near the stove, and you shouldn't let them either. TVs are another matter. I could see that entirely. If you're an investor, though, I think the point here that Dan is trying to make is you've got to make sure that you are fully covered for accidents, for fire, with your insurance, and make sure that your renter, your tenant, is buying the correct form of insurance. You can state that in your lease, and you can then require them to show you the receipt that they're going to get from the insurance company to make sure that you and the tenant are protected. Dan Goldstein is the real estate reporter for MarketWatch. Dan, so much fun. Thanks again for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Today, I'd like to answer a question from a listener of my former radio show who's looking to buy a rundown building that started out as a hotel and was later converted to condos. He'd like to buy the building, the whole building, and convert it back into a hotel, but wondered what steps he would need to take to make that happen, and whether he should start by buying some of the units, the many units that are already up for sale. Here's what I told him. Converting a condo building to apartments or a hotel requires getting a majority ownership of the condo building. So you need to start your quest to buy this building by sitting down with a real estate attorney who has extensive knowledge of condo law in your state. Now, some condo docs, and in some states, you might need half the ownership, some you might need 67% ownership, some 75% ownership, or in some cases, you might actually have to own 100% of everything, get all of the owners to agree to sell in order to get the whole building and control it. Now, if the building you're looking at has 50 condo units and each condo unit owner is a 2% owner in the building, each incremental percentage number may make up the purchase of the building more difficult and costly. You and your attorney have to review the condo docs for that building and then figure out what percentage of the ownership is actually required to permit the building to be sold as a whole unit. Your attorney can also tell you if the laws in your state require a higher majority than what the condo docs state. Now, I'm not sure buying units in the building is a good idea for you unless you're okay owning with the building unit, those building units, but don't have the ability to control the whole thing, right? So it's great to buy 20 units out of a 100-unit building, but it may not get you the whole building. You should also know that if you buy a good number of units in the building, the other owner-occupied units might suffer in value down the line. Of course, this could be a plus or a minus, right? A building that has a majority of investor-owned units does have a greater chance of having difficulty obtaining financing through conventional channels for future buyers. If other owners don't want to sell and financing units, if other owners don't want to sell and financing for units you don't buy is hard to come by, the building's maintenance and qualities may suffer further. On the other hand, this could be the leverage you need to convince the remaining owners to sell. After all, property values are going down. Once you determine what level of owner approval you need to buy the whole property, you can decide how to proceed. Now, if you need the approval of all the owners, you know that you can give it a shot, but expect that there's going to be at least one owner who's going to make it really difficult for you to buy the building, right? It's the law of numbers. If the percentage of owners set forth in the declaration is less than 100% that must approve the sale, then you'll need to gauge how difficult it will be for you to buy the whole thing. Remember, if you plan to buy units in the building, and if you don't research the process properly, you could end up in really bad shape, owning multiple units in a poorly run building and losing big time on your investment. There's some important news in the housing finance sector for homeowners and real estate investors who own property with 1 to 4 rental units. The director of the Federal Housing Finance Agency announced in a speech last week that FHFA will be extending the deadline for the incredibly successful refinancing programs they've had in place since 2009. HAMP, the Home Affordable Modification Program, and HARP, the Home Affordable Refinance Program, were set to expire at the end of 2015. But the news this week is that both will be available through the end of 2016. I gotta say, that's pretty great news for anybody who meets the eligibility requirements and hasn't already taken advantage of the assistance. Now, it's important to understand that HAMP and HARP target different categories of borrowers. HARP is aimed at homeowners who are underwater on their mortgages. These folks are making their payments on a mortgage that's worth more than the value of their homes, right? They're underwater. To be eligible, you must have obtained your loan on or before May 31st of 2009, and the loan-to-value ratio of your home must be greater than 80%. And while that seems impossible, there are so many people in certain states around the country that are still in that situation, even now, 6 years later. Other rules. You're going to need to be current on your mortgage with no late payments in the last 6 months and no more than one late payment in the last 12 months. The home for which you're refinancing has got to be your primary residence, a single unit second home, or a 1 to 4 unit investment property. Your loan will also need to be owned by Freddie Mac or Fannie Mae to qualify for HARP, but that's okay. Through 2014, 3.2 million borrowers refinanced through HARP, and the FHFA reports that nearly 40,000 homeowners in the Chicago area alone still qualify, for example, but have yet to take advantage of the potential savings. Don't wait. When it comes to HAMP, the target customer is someone who's fallen behind in the mortgage due to financial hardship and still owes up to about $730,000 on their loan. As long as you obtained your mortgage on or before January 1st, 2009, haven't been convicted of a crime related to mortgage or real estate transactions in the last 10 years, and you own a home that has not been condemned, you could be eligible for a loan modification. Seems like the bar is very low here. However, the good news is this can work for a personal residence or a 1 to 4 unit investment rental property as well. In the case of HAMP, there's a broader list of participating loan servicers. You can check out the complete list at makinghomeaffordable.gov under the availability menu. Now, these are really important opportunities for anybody who can qualify. So please, don't miss your chance to save money and potentially avoid foreclosure or a short sale. Because of this new and supposedly final extension to HAMP and HARP, you've got time to take advantage of the FHFA's mortgage relief programs. And I encourage you to do so. Hey, I hope you enjoyed today's episode of The Elyse Glink Show, and a big thank you to all of our guests. So if there was anything you missed or skipped over, don't worry. You can find the show notes to this episode at thinklink.com. That's thinkglink.com. Also, if you're new to the show, please be sure to subscribe to it. And if you're a regular listener and haven't already done so, please give us a rating or a review, preferably both, on iTunes. And you can do that by searching for The Elyse Glink Show in the podcast section of iTunes. And this helps the show get discovered by new people. And I'll just put in a little plug for my other show. I'm still doing Monday Morning Marketing with Elise Glink and John Byrne. We've done 3 or 4 episodes. So if you've got a small business and you're looking for really great tips on marketing and social media, public relations, you're going to want to tune into that. You can find it at thinkglinkmedia.com. All right, well, that's the end of another episode of The Elise Glink Show. I'm your host, Elise Glink, and I'll be back with a new episode next week. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great week.